Today's broadcast was originally recorded on October 9th, 2025.
The mass deportations continue, but in a strategic way, and we move the workforce towards automation and 100% American participation.
100% American participation? Does that include farm workers? Ag Secretary Brooke Rollins?
Well, I don't know why I came here tonight.
Just wondering.
I got the feeling that something ain't right.
Because I think it don't.
I'm so scared in case I fall off my chair.
We'll discuss.
And I'm wondering how I'll get down the stairs. Clowns to the left of me, jokers to the right. Here I am, stuck in the middle with you.
I am. From Pacifica Radio in Los Angeles, this is the broadcast as heard on KPFK 90.7 FM in LA and on dozens of other fine affiliate stations on both the public airwaves and the internets around the country and the world, blanketing planet Earth. I'm Brad Friedman, your friendly investigative blogger, journalist, troublemaker, muckraker, all-around swell fellow, says me. From bradblog.com. Thank you very much for joining us today for another all-too-thrilling edition of the Bradcast. We've got a whole lot to try and get to on today's show for a change, including what appears to be a breakthrough on a peace agreement, or at least the ceasefire agreement, including the long-sought release of Israeli hostages and the long-overdue restoration of humanitarian supplies into Gaza. That appears to be moving forward as we go to air, but we shall see. We'll have more details on that in a bit. Also, just before airtime today, after Donald Trump has been directing his corrupted Department of Justice to indict the New York Attorney General Tish James for something, anything, for months, as all too obvious revenge for her successful case finding Donald Trump and his companies and his sons guilty of major bank fraud in a huge corruption case last year. Well, James herself has now been reportedly indicted by a federal prosecutor in the Eastern District of Virginia. Yes, that same one who got an indictment against former FBI Director James Comey about 2 weeks ago, the same one who was Donald Trump's personal attorney who had never tried a case in her life, an insurance attorney, until she was named just about 2 weeks ago as the U.S. Attorney for the Eastern District.
The inexperienced and unqualified Lindsay Halligan strikes again.
She does. And, well, James Comey was ridiculously indicted about a week or so ago. We'll see if this indictment fares any better. More on that ahead as time allows. And also some details on those supposed photographs said to have been shown around by Jeffrey Epstein of Donald Trump with half-nude young girls, a matter which came up during bizarre Senate Judiciary Committee oversight hearings with Attorney General Pam Bondi earlier this week. And we will also have our latest Green News report with the aforementioned Desi Doyen.
Yay.
Hello, Des.
Hey.
But first today, we have, of course, been covering the ongoing federal government shutdown closely on this program. In fact, we have been doing so beginning weeks before it actually shut down, with folks like the American Prospect's David Dayan joining us for an early heads up about the coming spike in health care costs for nearly 25 million Americans who purchase their health insurance on the Affordable Care Act or Obamacare exchanges. As the Republican budget bill enacted during the summer this year effectively ended subsidies that will now result in monthly premiums more than doubling for tens of millions of Americans, even if all Americans are likely to see health care costs rise, due in no small part to the $1 trillion that Republicans also cut from Medicaid and about $500 billion in cuts to Medicare, unless lawmakers take action and do so quickly. Good luck with that. Democrats, meanwhile, appear to be holding firm to their demands that the Obamacare subsidies be restored and enacted permanently. And as we've discussed on this program, they are also demanding that assurances are written into any agreement with Republicans to prevent either Donald Trump or a bare majority of Republicans in Congress from simply rescinding spending agreed to by both parties to overcome the 60-vote threshold currently needed for passage of a spending bill in the U.S. Senate that might reopen the federal government. The Democrats can go along with the Republicans, say, sure, let's come to an agreement to get you those 60 votes, and then the Republicans or Donald Trump could just cut all of that spending. Our friend David Dayan has two stories out this week at the American Prospect that sort of tie into all of this in one way or another, and both have to do with farming one way or another. In one case, Donald Trump's huge unilaterally imposed tariffs have decimated portions of the U.S. farming industry after nations like China have simply stopped buying soybeans from the U.S. They were previously our number one customer by far. Trump has promised to grant farmers hurt by his major hurt by his policies. He's promised them major subsidies in a bailout to make up for the billions of dollars in lost business in the agriculture sector thanks to his tariffs. But those subsidies, much of which will go to huge agribusiness companies in which Republicans desperately want to put in place to help their rural voters hurt by Trump's policies, those subsidies must be approved by Congress first, perhaps giving new leverage to Democrats in their demands to reopen the government. David's other story, which I have only seen him reporting so far, is a bright spotlight that he's now shining on a remarkable admission published in the Federal Register just last week by Trump's own Department of Labor, conceding that Trump's mass immigration raids have devastated the agricultural workforce, have created a significant, quote, risk of supply shock-induced food shortages, according to the Labor Department, and that the department's solution for that is, well, likely to depress wages for all farm workers, including those who are U.S. citizens. Joining us now to explain both of these sort of remarkable stories for both farmers and, in particular, those who work for them and ensure the nation's food supply is the great David Dayan, investigative financial journalist, executive editor of the American Prospect, and award-winning author whose most recent book is titled Monopolized: Life in the Age of Corporate Power, in which, full disclosure, I am quoted once or twice. Mr. Dayan, welcome back to the broadcast, sir.
Is that the only reason I get back on the show? Because you were quoted in my book?
Well, that's why I paid you at the time to put me in there, so that seems only right. So, great work, David, on both of these excellent pieces. They are important, and especially the remarkable report on the immigration raids causing a food crisis here. Both of them have devils in the details. So I will, of course, link to both of them when posting the show at bradblog.com tonight. But I want to try and cover at least an overview, starting with the farm subsidies matter that Republicans need Democrats to help them pass, as far as I can tell. So first, why are these subsidies necessary again in a second Trump term? Didn't he already bail out the agribusiness industry during his first term?
He did. And the reason he needs to bail them out again in the second term is for the same reason as the first term: the consequences of Trump's own policies. In this case, it's tariffs. The tariffs that have been imposed on China created a very inevitable and obvious backlash whereby China has refused to buy, in particular, agricultural products from the United States. So that includes beef, which China is mostly getting from Australia, and it includes soybeans, which is a major commodity crop for the United States, which China is now largely buying from Brazil and Argentina. Now, the second part of that is quite remarkable, because the U.S. is bailing out Argentina right now to the tune of $20 billion.
Right.
And Argentina has taken that money and then put no restrictions on their exports and is now undercutting U.S. farmers in the global market.
they're selling what, soybeans to China?
Yeah.
Even while we're giving them $20 billion. And this is now run Argentina, run by his autocratic buddy, Javier Milei.
That's right.
Yeah. Now, that's just amazing right there.
So as a result of that, you have cattle ranchers, you have soybean farmers that have no outlet for their products. They're harvesting the products, but they have no outlet for them, no buyers available. So these soybean farmers in particular are wondering where their next check is going to come from and thinking about bankruptcy or just dissolving the business altogether. And so how is Trump reacting to that? He says, oh, we'll pay them off too. So think about this. We've paid off Argentina. Uh-huh. Argentine farmers are undercutting U.S. farmers in the global market, and now we're paying off U.S. farmers to compensate for that.
Well, that's just excellent policy, obviously, by the president, who's the great deal maker. Now, during the first term, when something similar happened, he was able to give that huge bailout to farmers on his own. He didn't have to go to get congressional approval. This time, you report, he needs Congress to do so, which means he also needs Democrats in the Senate to help overcome a filibuster to approve these subsidies for American farmers. What has changed? Why does he need Congress and, in fact, Democrats this time around when he didn't last time?
Yeah, it's because of a program called the Commodity Credit Corporation. And interestingly enough, it comes out of the New Deal. It was a program to help farmers during that time, and it's sort of been resurrected by the Trump administration in both the first and second terms. Mm-hmm. But the difference is that the Commodity Credit Corporation has to be funded. And in the first term, there happened to be a lot of money available that was authorized within the Commodity Credit Corporation. That is not true now. There is less than $4 billion in there. That's not going to do the job, considering all the damage that the tariffs have done to soybean farmers in the U.S. And so now the Trump administration has to get authorization from Congress to basically refill the coffers of the Commodity Credit Corporation so he can use that to bail out farmers.
And is one of the reasons there's only $4 billion left in it because in the first term he gave $20 billion or so to farmers out of that fund?
Well, sure. In part, it was not something that was widely used. There was just sort of this backstop, break glass in case of emergency, and that's what he did in the first term. It wasn't replenished in the second, in the Biden administration. And so here we are. And so now, in order for Trump to do what he wants to do, which is bail out farmers to cover for the consequences of his own policies, he's going to have to ask Congress for that.
Boy, those Republicans sure do like socialism when it helps out their corporate friends, doesn't it? You go into exactly how this leverage now for Democrats. Republicans need Democrats essentially for this funding and to save the farmers. So this is leverage for them, and Democrats are needed right now. And you suggest that this might be just the thing that's needed to bring Republicans around to make a deal with them on both health care and the farm bailout and what you describe as a no kings provision that Dems are asking for that would prevent Trump and Republicans from simply canceling any agreed upon spending unilaterally after Democrats help them reopen the government. Now, it's somewhat complicated, which means it's questionable, frankly, whether Democrats have the skills to pull this off or just to explain it to the public, because it does get complicated. But can you kind of summarize your thinking here on how Democrats could use all of this to their advantage in the standoff to come to some sort of a deal with Trump and Republicans?
Right. I mean, right now we're at an impasse on government funding. And Democrats are asking for two things. They're asking for, you know, some revision to the healthcare subsidies, extension of those subsidies for insurance coverage on the Obamacare exchanges. And they're asking in private that to guarantee that if we're going to pass a budget, that you're actually going to spend the money that we've appropriated, Donald Trump. So The idea is to make a bigger deal. So, I mean, Republicans aren't interested in these parts of the deal, but there's something else they want, and that is a farm bailout. Mm-hmm. So, okay, incorporate that into the deal, and then maybe that unlocks the ability to find a compromise mm-hmm. here. And, you know, I mean, I think it makes things a little more coherent. The thing that Republicans want to spend money on, the farm bailout, is kind of equivalent to the thing Democrats want to spend money on mm-hmm. in terms of the actual price tag, which is health care. And, you know, then you are passing a budget and saying, we're actually going to spend what's in the budget. So it just makes up for a more coherent deal, in my view.
And it's a great deal, frankly, for Republicans, because I think they're going to pay the price for this health care stuff once people see their health care premiums more than double in the coming weeks. It's odd that it is even this difficult to make it happen. I congratulate Democrats so far for standing strong on this, because everybody wants that. Everybody is, you know, it's wildly popular to these subsidies for Obamacare. It's going to hurt Republicans if they don't do something about it. So it does seem like they hold quite a few cards here. And this farm bailout issue is a big card to play. Now, on to your remarkable reporting, David Dayan, on what Trump's own Labor Department admitted last week is a food crisis being caused by Trump's own immigration policies. This and the administration's proposed remedy are just mind-blowing, David. Great find on your part regarding what the Labor Department admitted in the Federal Register last week. And I'll read part of it from your reporting, where they conceded, quote, "The near total cessation of the inflow of illegal aliens," their words, not yours or mine, "combined with the lack of an available legal workforce results in significant disruptions to production costs and threatening the stability of domestic food production and prices for U.S. consumers." This is according to the Labor Department. They add, quote, "This threat will grow given new federal funding for immigration enforcement under the so-called One Big Beautiful Bill Act." They are admitting that Trump's immigration policies are decimating the farm industry and the American food supply itself. Is this happening now, or is this a concern that it could happen in the future? What does the Labor Department say about that?
Well, it's quite a thing to admit. I mean, let's just stand back and talk about how remarkable it is that you have Trump's Labor Department saying that Trump's immigration enforcement is causing such disruption that we may not have enough food in America. Right?
Yes.
That is just remarkable to hold.
Yep.
Then you have to ask the question, well, is that true? Or are they just saying that in order to get something that they want? And my take on it, based on talking to experts, talking to labor unions, farm worker unions, is that it's not true. Is that the harvest went off fairly well this year. Some crops are seeing record, harvests mm-hmm. This year. And so you have to ask, well, why are they saying this? Mm-hmm. And the reason is they want to fast track something that the big agriculture companies have long wanted, mm-hmm. which are massive cuts to the guest worker wages that are for, workers who are brought in from overseas to work the fields. They have to stay with their specific employer. They don't have the same protections as U.S. domestic workers. And this has been growing as a tool for agribusiness. 20% now of all farm workers, crop workers in the field are these guest workers under this program called H-2A. Mm-hmm. And their prices are set through a methodology that is supposed to not have an adverse effect on U.S. workers in agriculture.
You say prices, you mean wages.
Their wages,
they agree,
I'm sorry.
These are, under this program, they agree to certain wages for these foreign farm workers to
That's
come
right.
here.
And it's supposed to be a wage that's set at such a level that U.S. farm workers can still get make a decent living.
Okay.
So what they did was they, in this rule, they changed the methodology to make it much lower prices or much lower wages for these guest workers, and they can charge them for their housing. It used to be the case that they would basically house these individuals on site, but now they can charge them rent for that, and that's an effective wage cut as well.
Yeah.
So in effect, in various states, these guest workers, the H-2A workers, would be paying below. They would be receiving below the minimum wage. And so they want to do this fast. And so to come up with a rationale to do it fast, they say they're saying all these things about immigration enforcement and there's a shortage of workers and you have to allow the ability for agribusiness to bring in these workers. But think about what they're actually saying from an econ 101 perspective. They're saying we have a labor shortage and our way out of it is to cut wages. I mean, think about that just from a perspective. Usually when you have a labor shortage, you want to entice people into the system by paying them more in wages. And if you're cutting guest worker wages, the U.S. workers are going to feel that effect. I mean, by definition, they're saying they set wages so it's not adversely affecting U.S. workers. Mm. If you're cutting wages of the competition, essentially, for those jobs, the wages of U.S. workers will go down as well. And how is that going to bring more people into the system of working in these in agriculture if their wages are just going to be cut? It seems to me that would make more people leave agriculture and produce less people available for this work.
Make more people leave both U.S. citizens who are farm workers and foreign workers who might say, well, the hell with that. They're paying me less. They're going to charge me for housing. Right. I mean, it's like early, 20th century pre-union company store stuff, it seems
it's
to me.
It's all company store stuff. And I have seen reports from some farmers and farm companies in Florida saying, we're concerned that we're not going to get as many applicants for the H-2A program because the wages are going down. So this is crazy about 17 different ways.
Yeah.
But it is really notable that here you have the Trump administration saying that the effects of their immigration policies are disastrous for the food system in the United States. Now, whether they're lying about it or not, it's an incredible admission.
Yeah.
Because the other part of the admission is saying U.S. workers will not take these jobs, which is the opposite of what MAGA has been saying for years and years and years.
Yep.
But they literally say that U.S. workers don't have the skills and don't have the ability to work these very hazardous jobs under difficult conditions. And, I think Steve Bannon or Laura Loomer or some of these MAGA types might be interested to know that Trump's Labor Department is saying all these things.
Exactly. And it's not just the Bannons and the Loomers. Ag Secretary Brooke Rollins, earlier this year, when the immigration crackdowns began, she said that the U.S. farm workforce would soon be 100% American thanks to those raids that were ongoing. What happened to that solution? Because now it seems like they want to hire more foreign workers than we had here in the first place. And by the way, there's no guarantee that when they do come here that they won't be rounded up anyway. If I were one of these farm workers, I'd consider going down to Argentina to work there. I hear they got a lot of money for this sort of thing.
I hear they have a lot of soybeans.
Yeah, that's what I hear.
So, yeah, I mean, that's one interesting thing about this is that, Brooke Rollins runs the USDA, the Department of Agriculture, but this wage setting for these guest workers, these H-2A workers, comes from the Labor Department. Mm-hmm. So you have two different federal agencies that are dealing with this. And while one agency is saying we're going to have 100% American workforce, the other agency is saying there's no way we can have 100% American workforce and we need to cut wages of guest workers overseas and bring more of them in.
The Labor Department states in their filing, quote, without swift action, agriculture employers will be unable to maintain operations and the nation's food supply will be at risk. Now, if we take them at their word, the question, if we're facing an American food crisis, as they claim, thanks to the administration's immigration policies, and they are proposing a solution that both makes it less advantageous for foreign workers to come here and it decreases wages for American workers. If we take them at their own terms, what are we even doing here, David? I mean, would this supposed solution even solve the supposed problem that it was meant to solve? Or is it going to just make any potential food shortages even worse?
I would invite you to contact the Labor Department in Washington, D.C. for the answer to that question.
Well, what happened when you contacted them?
I don't have it. Well, when I contacted them, they said, we're in a government shutdown, so we can't respond to you right now.
Okay.
And then I contacted Caroline Leavitt, who is the press secretary, because, you know, they're still working, and I didn't get a response at all.
So presuming this goes forward, and the reason this is in the Federal Register in the first place where you found it is because you have to sort of publish this stuff when you're enacting
Correct.
A new rule and explain
Right.
why. So presuming this new rule does go forward, and frankly, I don't even know who has the ability to stop them. But if it goes forward, who are the ultimate winners and losers here? And is there any way to prevent this new H-2A program from going forward as it's being proposed and, frankly, hurting both foreign and domestic U.S. farm workers alike?
Right. So the winners are obviously agribusinesses who will get to pay less for the labor that they need to pay out in order to produce crops. The losers, as you say, will be both foreign and domestic workers. The rule actually says outright that this will cost $2.4 billion a year in wages for farm workers. The United Farm Workers has said this is just a ploy to get exploitable labor, you know, into the United States. So that's and then, you know, if you continue to take them at their word and if you have any basic understanding of economics, this is going to exacerbate a food supply problem rather than mitigate it. And so, you know, you say who is going to be harmed by this? It's probably anybody that likes fruit or vegetables or nuts or anything like that that's picked.
Right. Incredible reporting. And by the way, that $2.4 billion that it will cost, that's money that will be saved by agribusiness. That's profit for them, right?
Direct transfer from the fields into the hands of the agribusinesses, yes.
You quote Daniel Costa, an attorney with the Economic Policy Institute who tracks the H-2A program, noting that agribusinesses, quote, are very capitalist, except when it comes to hiring and paying workers. Then they become the most left-wing central planners I've seen. They want the free market to prevail, except when it comes to paying the workers. In that case, we need government intervention immediately. Really exceptional reporting, David. Thank you for finding this. I will look forward to more such findings, I suspect, in the days ahead. Because I suspect no one's going to notice. But you will. Follow David Dayan on the social medias at ddayan. His work is at prospect.org. His article on this is Trump Labor Department says his immigration raids are causing a food crisis. We will link to that and his story on the farm bailout. Just amazing work in both cases. David is the executive editor of the American Prospect. He is also a 2021 Sidney Hillman Prize winner for magazine journalism and the author of both Chain of Title and Monopolize, Life in the Age of Corporate Power. Thank you, David.
All right. Thanks.
You bet. Okay, let's take a quick break. We got a lot more to get to today, unfortunately, including the supposed peace deal between Israel and Hamas and new charges, well, first charges filed against New York Attorney General Letitia James by Donald Trump's weaponized DOJ, and some new details from the Epstein files. That's all straight ahead on today's broadcast. I'm Brad Friedman.
The Bradcast and the Green News Report are 100% independent, 100% listener-supported. But we can't do it alone. We need you. Please help us bring real facts to listeners at independent stations around the nation. Please drop by bradblog.com/donate. That's bradblog.com/donate. And thanks.
Hey, this is Brad. You're listening to an encore presentation of the Bradcast. Welcome back to the Bradcast. Brad Friedman from bradblog.com. Thanks again to David Dayan of the American Prospect. I should also note coming up in a little bit, Desi Doyen's latest Green News report, but
yes,
we've got a ton of breaking news piling up today, so let me try to plow quickly through the at least the two most breaking and or noteworthy here before turning to some new disturbing details regarding Donald Trump and the Epstein files. All right, let's see. As you have likely heard by now, cautiously good news out of the Middle East. I remain much more cautious, I think, than most of the reporting that I have seen over the past 24 hours or so. But if things remain on the current track, at least, it would be very good news for Israel, for the people of war-torn Gaza, and, of course, for the remaining hostages being held in Gaza and their families and friends in Israel. There are a lot of things about this that remain hazy at this hour, but here's what we know. As of now, via AP, Israel and Hamas have agreed to a pause in their devastating two-year war and the release of the remaining hostages in exchange for Palestinian prisoners. A breakthrough greeted with joy and relief Thursday, but also, as AP similarly notes, caution. Just one reason for caution here: this would be the third ceasefire since the start of the war. The previous two also saw hostages and prisoners exchanged, but Israel ended the most recent ceasefire, which started in January, with a surprise bombardment in March. So, you know, we'll see. Uncertainty remains about aspects of the broader ceasefire plan advanced by the administration of Donald Trump, such as whether and how Hamas will disarm and who exactly will govern Gaza. But the sides appear closer than they have been in months to ending a war that has killed tens of thousands of Palestinians, reduced much of Gaza to rubble, brought famine to parts of the territory, and left dozens of hostages living and dead in Gaza. The war, which began with Hamas's deadly attack on Israel, a horrific attack just over 2 years ago now, on October 7 of 2023, has also triggered other conflicts in the region, sparked worldwide protests, and led to allegations of genocide, which the hard-right Israel government, led by Benjamin Netanyahu, denies. Even with the framework agreement said to be finalized soon, Israeli strikes continued on Thursday with explosions seen in northern Gaza. At least 11 dead Palestinians and another 49 who were wounded arrived at hospitals over the past 24 hours, according to the Gaza Health Ministry. Under the reported terms of this agreement, Hamas intends to release all living hostages in a matter of days, though I've noticed that timeline slipping a bit from as early as Saturday or Sunday to Monday, and most recently, Monday or Tuesday, while the Israeli military will begin a withdrawal from the majority of Gaza. This according to people familiar with the matter, speaking most of them on the condition of anonymity to AP. Some 20 of the 48 hostages still in captivity are believed to be alive, and they will all be returned according to this agreement. Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu planned to convene his smaller security cabinet and then the full cabinet to approve the deal. Hamas, meanwhile, called on Trump and the mediators to ensure that Israel implements, quote, without disavowal or delay, the promised troop withdrawal, the entry of aid into Gaza, and the exchange of prisoners. The UN aid chief said that 170,000 metric tons of aid was ready to go into Gaza as soon as entries to the war-torn enclave were once again finally reopened. The deal being submitted to Israel's government and then expected to be signed in Egypt will include a list of prisoners to be released and maps for the first phase of an Israeli withdrawal to new positions in Gaza. That's according to two Egyptian officials, a Hamas official and another official unnamed by AP. The withdrawal could start as soon as Thursday evening, according to the officials. Five border crossings would reopen, including the Rafah crossing between Gaza and Egypt, allowing 400 trucks in the initial days and increasing to 600 trucks after that, as food and medical aid flows in, according to Egyptian and Hamas officials. All of this, if it happens, obviously very, very good and long overdue news. If it happens, the plan calls for Israel to maintain an open-ended military presence inside of Gaza along its border with Israel, an international force comprised largely of troops from Arab and Muslim countries would be responsible for security inside of Gaza. However, AP is reporting, as I am speaking to you, that the U.S. says it will send about 200 troops to Israel to help support and monitor the Gaza ceasefire deal. So I hope that's a good idea. Hope we don't have another repeat of what happened in Lebanon some years ago when we had American troops there serving as peacekeepers and their barracks were bombed and many of them killed, leading to the withdrawal by Ronald Reagan from the region. The U.S. would lead a massive international-funded reconstruction effort, AP reports. What that means exactly, that's another one of those unknowns here at the moment. After withdrawing from agreed-upon areas of Gaza, the Israeli military will still control some 53% of the enclave, according to an Israeli spokesperson. The plan envisions an eventual role for the Palestinian Authority, something that Netanyahu has long opposed, but it requires the authority, which administers part of the West Bank, to undergo a sweeping reform program that could take years. So there's a lot that has to go right here. The plan being touted by Donald Trump and his administration is even more vague about a future Palestinian state, which Netanyahu still firmly rejects. Some 1,200 people were killed in the Hamas-led assault that triggered this war, and 251 were taken hostage at the time, back in October of 2023. In the ensuing offensive by Israel, more than 67,000 Palestinians have been killed in Gaza, nearly 170,000 wounded. According to Gaza's health ministry, around half of the deaths were women and children. So even with many details yet to be agreed, many are expressing relief at the apparent progress in both Israel and Gaza. So let's hope this time the agreement proceeds as it is being reported. There will be time to discuss what part of this Trump deserves any credit for. For now, I will just say that I agree with whoever wrote the closing words of one of his social media postings. I believe it was last night, in all caps, quote, "Blessed are the peacemakers." Now let's hope that both peace actually comes and that all of those who carried out war crimes over the past several years are someday held accountable for those crimes. Okay, back here at home, speaking of accountability, sort of, a grand jury has indicted the New York Attorney General, Letitia James, on a single fraud charge, according to a person familiar with the matter, speaking to the Associated Press on Thursday, after Donald Trump had publicly called for his Justice Department appointees to bring charges against her just over a week ago. Other outlets have now confirmed the charge as well, though it's unclear what exactly it is for. James was indicted in the Eastern District of Virginia on one count after a mortgage fraud investigation, according to AP's source. Other outlets like NBC have confirmed that reporting in their case from three unnamed people at least as we go to air. As I note, this just broke before airtime. In August, Attorney General Pam Bondi appointed a special attorney to probe mortgage fraud allegations against the New York AG, but that case hit a standstill last month because federal agents and prosecutors did not believe that they had evidence to secure a conviction. That, according to two senior federal law enforcement officials speaking to NBC. The indictment, 2 weeks after a separate criminal case charging former FBI Director James Comey with lying to Congress, is the latest indication of what AP describes as the Trump administration's norm-busting determination to use the law enforcement powers of the Justice Department to pursue the president's political foes and public figures who once investigated him. The shorter version of that is Donald Trump's weaponization of the Justice Department against his the people he believes to be are his enemies. The very thing that he falsely accused, with no evidence whatsoever, falsely accused the Biden administration of doing against him.
That is what the saying is. Every accusation is a confession.
Yep. Trump has been advocating charges against James for months, posting on social media without citing any evidence that she is, quote, guilty as hell, unquote, and telling reporters at the White House, quote, it looks to me like she's really guilty of something, but I really don't know. James is a second-term Democrat as the Attorney General in New York. She has denied any wrongdoing. She has said that she made an error while filling out a form related to the to a home purchase on behalf of her niece, but quickly rectified it, didn't deceive the lender in any way. Her lawyer was accused, has accused the Justice Department of concocting a bogus case against her in order to settle Trump's personal vendetta against James, who last year won a more than $500 million judgment against Trump and his companies and their executives, including his two eldest sons. It was a sweeping fraud lawsuit alleging that he lied to banks and others about the value of his assets. NBC reports the standard for securing an indictment before a federal grand jury is much lower than securing a unanimous conviction by a jury at trial. The Justice Manual, which guides federal prosecutors, says that attorneys for the government should only move forward on a case if they believe the admissible evidence would be good enough to obtain and sustain a conviction. That is clearly not the case in the Comey indictment. We will see if this one against James has any more legitimacy to it than that one, which I doubt will make it even to trial before being tossed out of court. We will see if this one fares any better, though I would not count on it. As the very smart legal eagles over at the Lawfare blog headlined their coverage of Trump's quest to indict Tish James this week, that headline was, quote, it's hard to imagine a worse case than the one against James Comey until you see the one against the Attorney General of New York. More on that, obviously, in the days ahead. And then there is this. As you should know by now, GOP House Speaker Mike Johnson is refusing to seat Arizona's Democratic representative-elect Adelaida Grijalva, who won her special election to the U.S. House 2.5 weeks ago, claiming, oh, he just can't do it because it's a scheduling issue. The House is currently out of session during the shutdown. It only meets briefly each day for a quick pro forma session to gavel the House into and out of daily session. Now, of course, Johnson could bring the House back at any time. He's the one who sent them away. And Florida Republican House members who won their special elections earlier this year were immediately sworn in the very next day after the election before their victories were even certified by the state. And yes, they were sworn in during a pro forma session in the House when it was otherwise on recess. So the obvious reason that Mike Johnson will not swear in Grijalva is because she has said she will sign on to the discharge petition to force a House vote on the release of the Epstein files. And Grijalva would be the 218th member to sign that petition, which just happens to be the exact same number needed to trigger that House vote to release those files on the convicted sex trafficker of minors, who also happened to be Donald Trump's best friend for 15 years. And Trump himself is reportedly named all over those files in various ways. In the meantime, as we reported earlier this week, Trump's U.S. Attorney General Pam Bondi, who is helping Trump to cover this up, she could release the files herself at any time. She testified before the U.S. Senate Judiciary Committee this week and had this interchange with Senator Sheldon Whitehouse, Democrat of Rhode Island.
Let me ask you something else. There's been public reporting that Jeffrey Epstein showed people photos of President Trump with half-naked young women. Do you know if the FBI found those photographs in their search of Jeffrey Epstein's safe or premises or otherwise? Have you seen any such thing?
You know, Senator Whitehouse, you sit here and make salacious remarks, once again trying to slander President Trump left and right. You're grilling me on President Trump and some photograph with Epstein? Come on.
The question is, did the FBI find those photographs that have been discussed publicly by a witness who claimed Jeffrey Epstein showed them to him? You don't know anything about that. Okay.
So notice she did not answer. She could have said, we found no such thing, but she didn't say anything about it. Well, now we've got some more on that public reporting on those photos said to have been shown by Jeffrey Epstein to a witness featuring Trump with half-naked young girls. It comes from Michael Wolff, who wrote a book about the first Trump administration based on hours of his reporting from inside the White House and hours of interviews with Trump himself and other administration officials. Michael Wolff appears to be the source of the reporting on those photos. He interviewed Jeffrey Epstein, reportedly, for many hours, and he explained, Michael Wolff did, in a video posted to social media following Bondi's testimony this week, exactly what he saw regarding those photos.
Senator Sheldon Whitehouse yesterday confronted the Attorney General Pam Bondi directly about the Epstein-Trump pictures. Had she seen them? Were they in the Trump files? She flatly refused to answer. I'm one of the people who has seen these pictures, so let me once again describe them. I have seen approximately a dozen pictures in snapshot or Polaroid form, each with Donald Trump and the girls who surrounded Jeffrey Epstein, who were at Jeffrey Epstein's house circa around 2000. This is in Epstein's backyard in Palm Beach, around the swimming pool. And there are three that I specifically remember. Two with young girls, I don't know their ages, sitting in Trump's lap, topless. And then a third with Trump standing up, and he has a stain on the front of his pants. And there are four or five of these girls, young women, girls, laughing and pointing at the stain. That's what I've seen. I've seen them on two separate occasions, the first in 2017, several months after Trump assumed the presidency, and another time, and I'd say it was probably 2018. In each instance, Epstein went to his safe, took out the pictures, and he did this because they amused him, and spread them out on his dining room table. Then he packed the pictures up very neatly, took them back, and put them in the safe. Now, I don't know if they were in the safe when the FBI came in July 2019 and emptied the safe, raided the house and emptied the safe. But it would not be a far-fetched assumption to assume that they were, and that now, today, they exist in the Epstein files.
That was author and reporter Michael Wolff speaking about what he says he saw regarding those pictures shown to him by Jeffrey Epstein, he says, of Trump with half-naked young girls.
Gross.
Yeah. And pretty specific details, however. So make of that what you will. Let's take a quick break and a quick shower, and we will come back with Desi Doyen and the Green News Report. I'm Brad Friedman. This is The Bradcast. Hey, this is Brad. Please consider supporting whichever progressive media outlet is serving you. Most, just like us, do not receive corporate or political support. We all need your support to counter the powerful corporate media echo chamber. From Desi Doyen and myself, thank you.
You're listening to an encore presentation of The Bradcast.
Okay, Desi Doyen, quickly, before any more news breaks, let's get to it, our latest Green News Report.
The Trump administration is going to open more than 13 million acres of national public land to lease for coal production.
But apparently no one wants to buy the Trump administration's dirty coal. Officials announce arrest connected to the catastrophic Pacific Palisades fire. Plus,
this is going to cripple science, and it is going to be disastrous.
Nobel Prize winner warns Trump's science cuts will have long-term consequences.
All of those consequences and more straight ahead from BradBlog.com. I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
Stand by for 6 minutes of independent green news, politics, analysis, and snarky comment.
It's not a shutdown. It's a shut-portunity. You know what they say? When God closes a food inspection program, he opens a listeria outbreak.
This is your Green News Report. Okay, Desi Doyen, it's been almost a year, but maybe we now know who and what started the Pacific Palisades fire?
Perhaps. Federal authorities in Los Angeles have arrested a man in Florida on suspicion of igniting a fire that eventually turned into the catastrophic Pacific Palisades fire in January that killed 12 people and destroyed nearly 8,000 structures. Mm. Officials called it a holdover fire. The initial fire was put out, but for days it smoldered undetected until it was rekindled by historic high winds exploding into the deadly Pacific Palisades. Fire. The cause of the Eaton fire in Altadena, 40 miles away on the same night, remains under investigation. Mounting evidence suggests that fire was sparked by faulty electrical equipment. In other news, the Trump Department of Energy has terminated more federal clean energy grants, canceling funding for all 7 hydrogen hubs appropriated by Congress under the bipartisan infrastructure law. Experts say the cancellations will significantly impact the development of the U.S. clean hydrogen industry and will hit both renewable energy companies and oil majors like Exxon and Chevron.
In addition to being incredibly stupid, it also seems to me to be incredibly unlawful.
It probably is, and it also raises concerns about the future of the clean hydrogen sector in the U.S. and the jobs it was supposed to create. Energy Secretary Chris Wright, a former fossil fuel CEO, has so far canceled nearly 700 clean energy projects across the U.S., collectively worth more than $24 billion.
Has he canceled any fossil fuel projects?
He has not.
Go figure.
The Nobel Prize in Chemistry was awarded this week to 3 scientists whose work could help combat climate change.
Well, that means I was overlooked again.
They developed molecular metal organic frameworks with large internal spaces, like the timber framework of a house, that can absorb and contain gases and chemicals. The innovation is already being used to harvest water from Arizona's desert air and could be developed to capture carbon dioxide, store hydrogen, and extract pollutants pollutants from water. In an interview with Reuters, Nobel Prize-winning physicist John Clark warned that the Trump administration's gutting of federal science research will have long-term negative consequences.
This is going to cripple science, and it is going to be disastrous. If this continues, assuming that the present administration finally comes to an end, it may take a decade to get back to where we were, say, half a year ago.
Assuming the current administration finally comes to an end.
Yep. Meanwhile, despite the Trump administration's attempts to prop up the declining U.S. coal industry, despite a $625 million taxpayer bailout and weakening pollution rules, no one appears to want it. Last week, the biggest coal lease sale on federal lands in more than a decade received only one bid of less than a penny per ton, leading the Trump administration to postpone the next sale of coal leases on federal lands in Wyoming. During the government shutdown, lease sales for fossil fuels are going forward, but not sales for renewable energy projects.
So they're putting all this coal on the market. Nobody wants your dirty, deadly coal.
And finally, electricity demand is rising globally, but solar and wind power in 2025 are growing faster than demand, leading to a fall in the use of fossil fuels for electricity compared to this time last year. The new analysis by energy think tank Ember also found that for the first time, cheaper renewable energy sources have overtaken coal globally and now generate more electricity than coal. Plus, deployment of renewable energy is surging worldwide, led by China. Ember also found that global investment in renewables has hit a new record in 2025, just not in the United States.
I wonder why. For much more on all of these stories and the ones we couldn't get to today, check out our website at greennews.bradblog.com. I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
And this has been your Green News Report. Thank you very much, Desiree.
Yes.
Desi Doyen, of course, is our producer. Thanks as well to David Dayan, our guest today from the American Prospect, and to all of you for spending a portion of your day or night with us. If you missed any portion of today's show or any other, you can download them anytime for free at bradblog.com. And hey, while you're there, please consider hitting a donate button. It would be pennies from heaven for us and greatly appreciated. You can also go straight to bradblog.com/donate to help us stay on your public airwaves. Drop me email. I am bradcast@bradblog.com. You can find me on the social medias, especially Blue Sky at The Brad Blog. You can find Desi Doyen there as well.
Green News Report.
At Green News Report. We will see you at all of the above. Until we see you here next time, I'm Brad Friedman. Good luck, world.
Pennies.